Welcome to Wizard Team, a Black Magical podcast for Black Magical Stories.
Hi everyone, it's Bayana, Robin, and Portia embarking on a journey through the many fantasy stories written by and about Black people. Today, we're really excited to be joined by Victor Laval, author of the 2023 release Lone Women, as well as the recently adapted for TV novel, The Changeling. Hi, Victor.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks for coming.
Oh yeah, it's a gift.
Okay, so just like starting off, can you briefly tell the audience what Lone Women is about?
Sure. Lone Women is set in 1915. It's about a woman named Adelaide Henry, who is from a Black farming family in Southern California. In the very opening of the novel, a horrific tragedy happens, and she has to flee the farm alone. And she runs to the wilds of Montana to homestead there. And the only thing she brings with her is a large steamer trunk. And the danger of it all is that whenever that steamer trunk opens, people die.
Spooky.
Totally fine.
It really does give a different concept with the idea of carrying baggage. Like,
what? Yeah, literally.
Yes, literally.
Yeah.
And how heavy
it
was.
A little on the nose, but I said, well, what are you going to do?
I felt, it definitely worked. I was like,
okay,
yeah,
I'm grateful.
Yeah.
You're, speaking of like carrying things, like you're known for writing stories based in the New York City area. You also are based in the Bronx. So thinking about the stories that you've written in the New York area, like The Aesthetic, The Devil in Silver, and The Ballad of Black Tom, to name a few. So your choice for location for Lone Women is a major coastal departure. It's like the actually opposite coast.
Complete opposite, yeah.
Right? And what was your initial inspiration for this story? Was it influenced at all by the places that we see, or was there another source of inspiration for it all?
Well, it's two things. The first was the book I wrote just before this was a novel called The Changeling, which was my, in a way, like my big love letter to New York City. It's about New York and about growing up in New York and about New York history and all the rest. And after I finished that book, even as a New Yorker, I was pretty sick of New York, to say nothing of how the rest of the world feels about New York, right? So I said, I really gotta write about somewhere else. But I wasn't necessarily sure about where. But a couple years earlier, I had read this book called Montana Women Homesteaders, A Field of One's Own, which was this history book I picked up just by chance in the local history section at the University of Montana bookstore when I went to do a reading there years ago. Like anytime I travel somewhere that's not New York, if I'm not there for very long, I try to pick up a book of local history while I'm there and bring it back so that I can at least, even if I don't experience the place because I'm only there for a day or two, I can learn about the place I was. Right. And this is also like maybe being born and raised in New York, being born and raised anywhere. It's very easy to only be focused on where you're from and just trying to expand my mind about the world, you know. So in that book, the whole book is about lone women homesteaders, meaning women who went out to places like Montana in the early 1900s. And they were able to claim land. They didn't need to have a husband co-sign. They didn't need to have a father co-sign. Anything like that. And that was a surprise to me, number one, because I think my own ideas about the time was like a woman on her own would never be allowed that degree of independence, right? So that was already a surprise. But then the second surprise, I assumed like, well, it'll only be white women who had the right to this. But the book, the whole point of the book, or like one of the points of the book was, it was not only white women, that there were Black women homesteaders. There were Chicana women who came from Mexico and homesteaded. But then it got more complicated because then it turned out like, but Chinese people couldn't homestead because in that period of time, in that part of the country, the greatest prejudice was against Chinese people, largely because they had come to the U.S. and were doing too well. And you know what happens. Whenever someone's doing too well, we got to make a law to make it illegal. So they did that to the Chinese. And the more that I dug into this, To say nothing of course, also the indigenous population there could not be homesteaders for a while at least. And then at a certain point they could. But all of this was so complicated and interesting. And was it the opposite of what I thought it must be like? And so to me, that was the thing that made me lean in and say, like, okay, if this is surprising to me, it might be surprising and interesting to other people too.
Yeah, I recently did a, I don't know how recently, but I did a road trip out into the plains, and those like descriptions in the book about just like those wide expanses and the wind and the sky, like it's interesting because I was like, oh, I see that still, even though it's been, you know, you think it's so much modern and stuff, but there's like nothing in modern.
Yes. Yes.
There's little pockets of things, but then there's just like a lot of land. So Lone Woman does, it follows a Black woman in 1915 in this unique space where you wouldn't really think of Black women being, what drew you to that time period, that year? And then kind of in the, you know, there's a lot of stories and things around like Black people in the early 1900s in like cities, but
right.
What kind of drew you to this like time period and locale?
Well, as I was reading through that that history book, that Montana Women Homesteaders book, there was a mention of one woman in particular named Birdie Brown, who was a Black woman homesteader in Montana, and who it was just kind of in passing, but they said like, was famous in part because she had the best, essentially the best moonshine in three states. And it was one of the ways she made her living. And for me, like I kind of, that was enough for me to start saying, well, if there was a Birdie Brown, I bet maybe there were some others. And as I did more research, I found there was another Black woman homesteader named Annie Morgan, who was a little before Birdie Brown. And I started finding just, I mean, in the end, maybe like a half a dozen, right? But that's enough. That was enough for me mm-hmm. to say they're there. And like, and also to like one of the pleasures I took was feeling like if I put this together and I publish this, the joy I would feel when there would be some people who'd be like, oh, look at them trying to make the West woke and trying to put Black women there when there were none and being able to say, you're just ignorant and you're just wrong. And the idea like that we've always been there. This is not a new thing, you know? And so it was just so much fun to try to picture that and put that in there. But then I would also say, so that was the historical reason for doing it. But then on the more personal reason for doing it. So my mom is from Uganda and came to the United States. Well, she came to Canada. Funny story is she came to Canada and found Canada too racist. So she came to the United States to do. She was like, maybe the U.S. will be better. And like we laugh about that to this day where she was like, oh. Okay, maybe all of North America was a problem. But nevertheless, she came here, came to New York, didn't have anybody, and like made a life, had me and my sister, brought my grandmother over, and we made our life here. And the more I was like thinking about these Black women out West and these women in general out West doing it alone, the more I was thinking of my mom and the kind of the courage, the risk taking of it all to just come and do it and just say, well, one way or the other, I'm going to make this work. And so that was my way. I had the historical stuff, but it was also my way of maybe in a way sort of writing about my mom and trying to imagine the bravery of her doing this thing and doing it so well, you know, like, I mean, we survived to adulthood, so. I think she succeeded.
Yeah, shout out to your mom.
Yes, really. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's definitely something that like struck me about Adelaide and even the other like perspectives and like other people that she came across is just like they were all just like, okay, we're about to do this, and mm-hmm. yeah, we're in the middle of nowhere, and yeah, it's the middle of winter, and we're gonna have to figure out like how to make it through. and then just
and like, helping each other happen. While also being skeptical, which is like kind of like yeah. your mom is like, eh, it's yes. racist here, maybe there's somewhere you know, making it work while still being, you know,
I mean, the great vigilant. Thing about the U.S. is that, like, something that I, like, when I went to Toronto that I was spoken to Black Torontoans was mm-hmm. interesting because they were talking about how, yeah, you got racism, but at least y'all have each other. Like, they don't really like, a Black community where it's, like, called, like, are coming together all the time. They have their different, like, you know, migrant
yes. identities. Yes.
But in America, it's like, well, we're all Black, so we're just going to be Black together. Like,
yes.
That'll be the...
Well, I mean, the U.S., it's like those categories are so like you just it's this box or this box. I mean, broadly speaking, right? Like mm-hmm. maybe more recently in theory, there's other boxes, I guess. But even that, I tend to feel like, ah, you're kidding yourself. There's only two boxes in the US and you need to figure out which box. Right. Like and so I agree, like it allows for a degree of like not getting into, well, you're from Trinidad, I'm from Jamaica, I'm from St. Lucia, so we can't help each other. You'd be like, you could, and you could, yeah. you could do better as a result or whatever, you know, I mean, that's a very American US point of view, but I agree with you. I do think it's a gift or yeah. can be.
Depending. Most of the time,
makes the best like of a is. Bad thing, right? Like
yeah, absolutely.
In theory, you wish you didn't have to team up. But the right. U.S.
You have
U.S.
to.
Makes you team up.
You and the fact that you can, though, is like is a blessing. Like
I think so. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So your writing is really visual and like cinematic. Was that an intentional choice in this case, or was it just like is that just how you write? Or and did the finished product kind of look how you were envisioning it when you were first like you know reading that book and getting that inspiration?
I think my writing has changed over time. And the earlier books, I think, are maybe a little less visual, more like dialogue and voice kind of thing. But as time has gone by, I'm thinking like when I'm reading things or whatever, I have a hard time, I mean, it seems silly, like I have a hard time picturing things very easily. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, in a weird way, if people describe too much, I get lost too. You know, like a page and a half of how someone looks, I can't see them anymore. But if it's like a good two lines that kind of sums up something, their faces, I mean, it's a terrible version, but their face is bright as the sun or something like that. On some level, I get it. Like when they look at you, it feels like they're shining and you're basking in the warmth, and I get it. And so as time has gone by, I felt more and more like, let me try to do that so that if someone is a reader like me, they get just enough to picture it, but not so much that they drown, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, and the final product. Yeah, I mean, the original, like originally I wrote this as a longest short story that was in an anthology called Long Hidden. It's a great anthology. It's like lots of different writers writing like speculative versions of American history. And I wrote the story for that, but the story ended without any spoilers. It ended right after the scene with the Mudges. Like after things all come to a conclusion with when the Mudge family comes to visit Adelaide, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of ended there and then that was it. But I like after some time, I started thinking like, I think there's more story to tell here. And in particular, there's more between Adelaide and without revealing anything again, and the surprise other person who matters a lot to Adelaide. And so I just thought, let me go back. I want to tell more of this story.
I like that.
Yeah, the Mudges are a whole mess. we're going to get a little bit into there. So, like, I kind of like going, like, pulling out a little bit. So the title, like the final title for Lone Woman, I know like as a writer, you go through, probably go through like a lot of different ideas for titles as things go on. But the final title for the story ends up being Lone Women, which implies two antithetical like concepts, like lone as in like a singular existence, and then women, like a plurality of people who consider themselves a woman. So as you read the novel, you come to understand that Adelaide is on a journey. Like she starts off like lonely, and even though she has her baggage with her, the loneliness is like the oppressing like emotion that she's going with. But it's throughout her journey, even when she's kind of resistant to engaging in community, she finds a community and women who are also like facing the pressure of like being homesteaders and building that life on their own, and then using only their own abilities and like what resources they've been able to develop. And this is all during a time period where we're told like this is unusual behavior, right? Especially for women. How early in your writing of the story did you think that community had to be part of what her Adelaide's journey included, and was necessary for her character development and growth?
Well, I knew, I mean, again, like going back to reading that first history book, and then I read other stuff, because as I got more interested in the time period and the region and all the rest, but like one thing that came up again and again in that book was, whether it was the lone women or just homesteaders in general, was the sense that like the land was so hard to live in that you could not afford to be sort of an individualist. Like nobody, even if the closest neighbor is 5 miles away, you hate them, they hate you. But if you run out of firewood, they will give you firewood. If they run out of water, you will give them water, because you know that this land will happily kill all of you and not even notice, right? The wind will just blow you away. And so that really stayed with me, that sense that like, you can't write this as a story where she goes out on the homestead and she does it all herself, because nobody could, which then led to the question of like, cause originally it was going to be Adelaide and her baggage, so to speak, just going out. Right. But the more I read, the more I was like, it's impossible. So then who are these other people going to be? And then it became fun to think, to the point about the title, instead of lone woman, there were other women. So there's the fun irony of like alone, but it's plural women. Who are these other women? All of a sudden I started wondering about, and then I started saying like, well, what if she does find family out there, and she finds these other women? Because the other thing about the book was it talked about like the kind of woman who did this was often a woman for whom the life they were, like it was better to leave the life they were in and come out here than to stay. And then thinking about like, this place is deadly, is almost gonna kill you, and it's better than what you left. So what must these women be leaving behind, right? And so then that was exciting to sort of say, okay, you know, they all have stories. It's not just Adelaide. They all have things they're running from. And then making that found family then kind of go up against, in a sense, like the town as a more traditional sense of like, oh, this is how you're supposed to do things, right? We're nuclear families, we're married couples, we're men, we're respectable, blah, 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 whatever that means. And then here's these outsiders over here. And what happens when those two sides sort of clash?
Yeah, like they literally live on the fringes of both, yes, like the social sphere, yeah, and like the fringes of the town limits and stuff. So yeah, it's really great allegory. You know,
like, yeah, it was, I mean, the nice thing was like there were so many. One of the things I will say as a writer, excuse me, as I get older, I think when I was a newer writer, I would sort of say, again, like the baggage thing, oh, that's too on the nose. Some of them should live in the town, you know, like. But as I get older, I start to say, just lean into it. It's fine. And people will actually get what you mean, instead of like, oh, Ed, you have to unravel all my secret meanings. Stop it. Just let people understand you.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like when it's like an intentional, like this is what it is, whether it's on the nose or not, if you're like, no, this is what it is, and you lean into that instead of trying to like maintain some mystery with it, like it definitely, I feel like it is effective.
And
I agree.
Done well. So it's like, it doesn't matter. Like, I was still like, what's in the.
What's in the baggage?
Right.
But also, I don't want to know what's in the baggage. So why was it important for Adelaide to develop a found family while also, you know, thinking back to all of the pain and responsibility put on her by the family she was born into and like where she left, even as she's leaving to go to this new place, you kind of thinking that she wants to be alone, like alone mm-hmm. is kind of where she'll feel safe, but then kind of despite herself, but also like you said, because it's necessary, she makes these connections, but then they become deep. Why was it important for you for her to have that kind of found family?
Well, I guess there's two things. Number one, I suppose is like an ongoing theme for me. I think from my own personal life is I know that there are lots of people who have probably like uncomplicated feelings about their family, and they're close with their family. Their family and them are always supportive. I don't think I've met those people, but I'm sure that they must exist, right? Because there's so much media that takes that for granted, like always choose family over anyone else, always. And I always see that thing and I go like, always? Because I gotta tell you, sometimes I really choose strangers over my family, like for sure. And so I feel like I have a very complicated, I have a complex feeling about that idea. And that in fact, as I've grown older, I've found there are some family members who I love with all my heart and I hold them close. And there's some family members I have learned we're just not in touch. We are blood, but we're not family, if that makes sense. And then I have met people in my life as life has gone on who are family to me, even though obviously we're not blood. And so in the case of Adelaide, I did want to write about a person who had every reason to want to escape family because the family she came from had baggage, had chains, had weight that might make one want to run away forever. But then what she runs into is the truth that not everybody, but for many, many, many people, we do want some connection. You know, we do want some support and love in the world. And then if we're lucky, sometimes we don't find it with the people, with the family we're born into. If we're very lucky, we might find it with other people. You know, and I wanted Adelaide, I didn't want to punish Adelaide, I wanted Adelaide to find it.
Yeah, that's great. And I really liked the moments of like flashbacks when she was kind of thinking back on her family, and initially like you feel her sorrow the entire time, but like as the story goes on, you see like how complex it is and like mm-hmm. how she holds this love and like, you know, grief for her family, but also like resentments and like, you mm-hmm. know, things that she's like, okay, this was actually not cool and I actually hate that we had to do this. And being able to like hold both while also moving forward was like really cool.
I appreciate that. I mean, I do think, you know, like, that is a part of growing up, right? It's like maybe if you're lucky, like when you're a kid, it's you love your family, you adore them, they're amazing, or some version of that. And then maybe when you're a teenager or into your early 20s, at least my experience, you're awful. I hate all of you, blah, blah. Even if I can't say it, but I'm thinking it, right? And then hopefully, as long as no one is truly terrible, the like third stage after that is like, I love this about you, but I also criticize this about you. And I'm sure that, and you do it to me, but maybe we find a way to be at peace with each other.
Yeah. The understanding that your parents make mistakes and that those mistakes inform your life, but don't have to like become your life, I think is something that you find in Adelaide's story. And there's a particular scene when she's, confronting that, mm-hmm. And confronting her parents or her,
the burden her parents put on her, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, there's a scene that I think really like highlights that I think is like, it stuck out to me. And also it was at a point in the book where I was like, what is happening? but was also something that I think that like adults would kind of want to be able to do is kind of unburden themselves and have those honest conversations with the people that they love. I don't know how to finish the sentence.
Spoiling.
I enjoyed it.
Cool. I was going to say, we can go to the next question so you don't spoil it.
I'm notorious for spoiling things.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
That's why the most of the podcast is spoiler heavy. I'm doing my best.
So, we talked about Adelaide and like the group of women that she allies with, finds family in, but she also has to deal with like these underhanded townsfolk. We also mentioned the Mudges already. There's another lone adult woman with like 4 kids. Did you find fun in writing these like antagonists? Because they definitely felt like there was like a level of like there was the danger and you can feel the stakes, but it was also like a little like ridiculous and it's just like it's kind of like funny in some ways.
I had so much fun in particular writing the Mudges. Like they're to me they were you know, in a way, like the mirror opposite of Adelaide and the other lone women, right? Like, but in particular, the mirror opposite of Adelaide, in the sense of like, this is another Mrs. Mudge. It's another woman coming out here alone. She's bringing, in a sense, her baggage, right? She's bringing these 4 mm-hmm. boys, and in theory, from the perspective of like the townspeople or whatever, she would probably be the one who would get the empathy and the care more, in part because she's got these 4 boys and they seem to be blind and blah, 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 all these kind of things. And so I had so much fun with this idea that they are kind of the mirrors of each other and where Adelaide is sort of, for a while at least, is kind of deep in her grief and her sadness and all this stuff. Mrs. Mudge loves who she is. Like she's having a good time. She, in a way, she's kind of having a good time, and she's really good. Without spoilers, she's really good at what she does, mm-hmm. you know. And I kind of loved it, you know, and loved letting that energy in as well. So, and also, you know, that sense too of like not wanting to turn it into a kind of thing like, well, all the women are good and they're always nice to each other. Right. No. They're all everything. The women here are all the range of all the feelings and the choices and the actions and all the rest. So if they felt like they were like over the top and a little funny and all stuff, I'm very happy because that's definitely what I wanted for them. And for that sense of threat, obviously, as well.
It also kind of like reminded me because like in this time period, clearly like the amusements were kind of low, but especially in the plains region where there's like nothing. So like it reminded me like a little bit of the dynamics or a little bit like a circus a bit with the like hijinks of it all, but also like it was very much like the kind of hijinks you don't want to be a part of.
That's right.
Like, it's great to see on TV, but not like in person to happen to you. No, that would not be amusing. So right. It was interesting seeing Adelaide go and have to like handle that. And that's something that like she's already going through so much. So here's one more thing to like figure out. And I think that like that character like development, even for like the like non-main characters in your work is really interesting to see. But then thinking back about your main characters and both Lone Women and the Changeling, the protagonists are lured towards areas where they haven't yet explored, that they haven't yet explored. In Lone Women, it's the Plains region. And the Changeling, the main character is not, he's from New York, but he's not like in Queens, like for all the time. And as someone who first, this is an aside, but like as someone who the first, when I first moved to New York, I lived in Queens. Uh-huh. It was interesting to me that that was his journey, was like coming from, he was the opposite. Like I've never lived in like Manhattan or the Bronx, but it was interesting seeing someone who's, that was their journey, was like going to Queens, and I started from Queens. It was like an interesting back.
Not very many people go to Queens, like choose to go to Queens.
You have to be in Queens to be in, like, it's a thing.
It's true.
So it was really interesting to me that I was like, oh, like just because of the nature of like curiosity around like the work that he does, he's lured out to Queens. Like he had to have a reason to be there. What do you find most compelling about using the call of like curiosity, but also a sense of like desperation, which is also part of both of their stories, like why they're forced to go on those journeys to build their character motivation? How does that like appeal to you as a writing kind of motivation kind of arc thing?
Well, I mean, I am interested in just getting characters on the move a little bit, in part because like when someone is put in an unfamiliar place, you're more likely to make it vivid because it's the first time you're seeing this or that, and therefore you have a right to go into all the details. But like, if the character's in their usual place, like any of us, you start to forget the details of your home because you're so used to them, you know. And so on the purely writing level, it's an excuse to like, you know, you say like, well, why would the main character walk into their bedroom for the thousandth time and go into four pages about their bedroom? Right. The reader needs that, but why would the character need that? Especially if it's like first person kind of thing, you know? So travel is an excuse to just do that thing. But then as far as like desperation, I guess in a way, like it's good for telling stories. You know, like when somebody really needs something, really wants something, it's a cliche almost, right? Like, what does the character want? By this point, I found it actually works, especially if what they want is something on some level understandable, even if it's not relatable, like understandable, you know? Like, so in The Changeling, Apollo, he's making a living. He needs to go buy these books to make a living, to take care of his wife and to help take care of his wife and newborn child. And you kind of say, okay, I think that's clear and understandable. And then it takes him into these completely wild places, but that's the draw kind of thing. And then for Adelaide, from the opening chapter, you understand why she can't, you understand that she can't stay where her family is from. Mm-hmm. And part of the mystery is, but why? Like, what happened? I saw what happened, but I don't know what caused it. And so I'm curious about that, but I understand why she has to run, why she's a fugitive at the start. And then as the story sort of unravels, you understand, it wasn't just that she had to escape a bad situation. It was also like she had to flee the life she'd been raised in on an emotional level. And so then that hopefully also then feels more complex and deeper, but also maybe people can relate to that too, you know, like, I had to get out of my old life, or I had to get out of the life my family raised me in, because it wasn't the life, it was killing me, you know? I think that's a common enough thing that it could draw you. If anything, sometimes in the past, like earlier in my writing career, sometimes I would have my characters have a desire, but I didn't understand that I should communicate that desire clearly to the reader. And so like, I remember like when I was in writing classes, and one of the things that would come is like, why are they doing this? And I would say, oh, isn't it obvious they don't want this or this to happen? And they'd go, where is that? And there'd be like one sentence buried 13 pages in that would be like in passing. There's the motivation. And they'd be like, how about you put that on page one? Could they just say that, you know? And you go, oh, yeah, I guess they could. Yeah. So these days it serves well.
Process. Yeah, it's such a hard thing when writing to like remember that nobody else is in your brain.
Really hard.
Like, isn't this like I said it right, or at least I thought it, so yeah. It means it should be on the page.
Yes. But it's funny, I remember having a writing teacher who said there's really only two kinds of writers as far as he was concerned. There's the writers who say way too much, and the writers who say way too little. And he said, the writers who say way too much are much easier to help because you just say, instead of these, all of this, just cut it. All you need is this. But the writers who say too little by nature are the kind who don't want to say too much. So you have to like jam a hook inside their brain or something like that and just pull so hard because you say like, instead of one sentence, we need three. And then they'll be like, how about one and a half? You know? And you'd be like, please, three sentences and I'm in this thing.
Right.
And it'll take the whole semester to get them to give you three sentences that explain the core thing. And he told me that saying, and you're the kind who doesn't say enough. So just stop it. And I had to, and it took maybe 15 years to stop. So.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine it's such a difficult, like, it's just like, how do you translate it onto the page in a way that, like, makes sense to other people, but also, like, accurately reflects what you're trying to do? It's like...
That's right.
Yeah.
And also,
and like you said, isn't so, like, here. Though, as someone with ADHD and a little neuro spiciness to my brain, I would love it if every author just started off with, like, an opening page of just, like, here. This is the journey you're about to go on. This is the ride.
Right.
But we're enjoy. I'm constantly like, these two get, they're the worst because I will like be messaging them, especially about a book they've told me to read and be like, what happened? And they're like, just keep reading. And I'm like, no.
I need to understand.
I can't keep reading until you tell me that everything is going to be okay or everything is not going to be okay. But this like in between where I don't know.
Well, do you ever do? I mean, I know of some people who like they read the last chapter.
Oh, I Wikipedia.
First. Yeah.
I need the full thing because if I just read the last chapter, like I'm still confused. I need to know exactly what happened,
and then you can follow.
Go along on the ride.
Right.
So I'm also one of those people. Like even when I'm watching like movies and stuff, I will have read the entire plot.
Right.
Synopsis, like know exactly what's happening, and then I'm ready to watch it.
I feel like learning, like whatever is the path that helps you enjoy the thing you like, you know, enjoy things.
Yeah, it's harder to do with books, so people don't like to spoil books. I've tried.
Maybe I don't know if you want to do it, but somebody should just like make a website, be like, look,
yeah,
spoilers for people who are have anxiety. Like.
I could actually see that being like a really like hitting a nerve, like even just like it was like a YouTube channel or something like that, where I'm now going to spend 2 minutes. I'm going to tell you that everything that happened in this story and how many people would be like, oh, I really needed that.
Yeah. Everyone with anxiety. Cause the not knowing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Everyone with anxiety and every high school student with a book report.
Yes.
You know what I mean? That would also be a huge gift.
Absolutely. Yeah, they did not want to tell me what was in the baggage.
What was in the baggage?
Yeah, you have to experience that. Like you have to like
I don't. I just.
Just tell me. Yes.
Why did she bring it with her? That was my thing. Leave it there. Just escape.
Yeah, but then, but if you've been raised with the responsibility,
yeah. And I think that made sense too, of like she's leaving and she can't stay, but she's still also taking some of that with her, which is like an interesting thing of her wanting to leave but feeling like she can't. And like,
yeah, and you can't leave it behind completely because it's in the middle of your
house. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Here on Wizard Team, it's no surprise that we love books. We also love supporting the independent bookstores.
With our bookshop affiliate link, you can not only get all the books on your TBR, but you can support indie bookstores and BNC at the same time.
And if you're not sure what you want, that ain't no problem. Check out our The Plot Thickens list full of recommendations from none other than Portia herself.
Head to www.bookshop.org/shop/blacknerdscreate to treat your shelves.
Treat your shelves.
Oh, that's nice. That's clever.
Oh my goodness.
That's clever.
It's a new year and we're so excited to bring you all kinds of nerdy and creative content, but we can't do that without your support.
Becoming a BNC baddie helps us with the general upkeep of our site, upgrade equipment, and invest in the team's creative development.
Go to help out your favorite nerds and stay for cool perks like monthly live streams, behind the scenes and bonus content, and more. If supporting Black creators sounds like your bag, you can sign up at www.patreon.com/blacknerdscreate.
Okay, so the next couple questions are about the Changeling. Sure. I guess initially, just what inspired you to write it?
Well, in a funny way, that's the one book I know exactly the day it was created, and it was the day our first son was born, May 21st, 2011. That was the start of that book. He was born. I suddenly went from really hating people with children, because I could care less about your stupid kid, was kind of like, you know, is my feeling all the time pre-kids. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, but my kid is special. Everyone wants to know about mine, right? And I hopefully, like after a couple months, after the exhaustion starts to wear off a little bit, honestly, after the first year and the exhaustion starts to wear off, I started to have the distance to be like, oh, that's the trick, is like, mm-hmm. You start thinking, but yours is valuable. And then that's the egotism of parenting, right? But that's also the only way you could love this thing that is trying to kill you, like every day, right? Yeah. I became interested in writing about the blend of those things, right? Both those feelings, like, I love this person more than anything in the world, but also like, if you're married and you have these two kids, or you're with a partner and you have these two kids, I mean, you have the kid, one of the things that can happen, often happens for a lot of folks, is like, you love each other so much that you have the child, but then having the child jams in between the two, and it takes so much of your energy, you can't actually give any of your energy to that person you love. Mm-hmm. And you even start to maybe dislike that person, because why are you here making other rules than the rules I'm trying to make for this thing? And what do you mean I got to talk to you? I've just spent all day talking to this thing, or holding this thing, or feeding this thing, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I felt like before having the kids, before having our son, our first son, we have two, before the first, our first son, I could be wrong, but I thought like a lot of those kind of complicated feelings were not things I often read about or heard about in books, or I wanted to add mine to it, you know? And then, but then to the point about like stress or danger, I said like, well, but I don't want to just write a story about a couple who have a kid and then it's exhausting. Like, who cares? You know, like that's every story like that. And why should anybody care about this one? And I said, oh, but what if the wife begins to say the baby has been stolen and has been traded out for a changeling? And the husband won't believe her because he doesn't see it, but also because they're so distant from each other now that he's doubting her and he's not being very kind to her. And then build from there and like letting that jump into a fairy tale. And so that felt very exciting to me. And I also thought like that blend of hopefully like realism and the fantastic might be fun for some people, at least. and then last, I wanted to write it right at that time, because what other people say all the time, right, is like, if you have kids, cherish it now because it goes so fast and all that kind of stuff. But one of the things that also happens is you forget all the mm-hmm. unfortunate parts, right? And I didn't want to forget those parts. I wanted to have all those parts that were disturbing and painful and embarrassing and all that kind of stuff. I wanted all that in there. So all of that is kind of what I poured in there. And I really felt like, in a way, I don't know if they would want it, but when our kids grow up, if they ever want to know what it was like for their mom and dad when they were born, forget all those happy things we say now that they're grown. Right. This is what it was like.
We were convinced that you were not a
Yes. Yes.
But it's also kind of funny because, in a way, the novel ends up being the same thing of, like, you were trying to, like, explore with, it's like, it's still the special thing. Like, but again, your journey is special. Like, yes. You're a kid. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. the special part of it all. Yes. So that's so cool.
And, you know, and hopefully, yeah, that idea that, like, but on some level, everyone's journey, I hoped also under there, is like, there's no one special journey, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that it was definitely not some sort of thing of, like, that's why I specifically had Patrice and Dana, Apollo's best friend and his wife, where they were like, he says at one point, like, you should have kids. And Patrice is like, you must be joking. I don't want these kids. And that they're very happy. Like, I mm-hmm. intentionally made their lives actually very loving, very happy. They don't get killed off to, like, show you that being child-free is the bad choice. In fact, like, by the end of the book, you're sort of like, I think their choice was actually a decent choice.
I mean,
you know,
they're still at home. Like, they're
they're still at home in love and enjoying themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was, like, very intentional, because I did not want it to turn into some weird, like, parenting is the best thing to do with your life
mm-hmm.
kind of story either, you know?
Yeah. So The Changeling has been adapted, and you can watch it now on Apple TV Plus. We always hear about authors getting their books optioned, and, like, sometimes it happens before the book is even out.
Yeah.
And there's all of this, like, kind of excitement, and then it takes forever or yeah. nothing ever comes from it. What was it like for you, the process of The Changeling getting optioned or adapted to the screen and then actually, you know, coming to fruition?
Yeah, well, I will say, so it wasn't the first thing that I'd ever had optioned. And so there was a part of me, like, like, on some level, like, the minimum good of getting getting something optioned is at least they got to give you a check for the option, right? You make a little money. Like, in our case, in the past, it was enough to send our kids to summer camp, right? And that is a gift and a half in life, right? So trying to think of it that way started to become my way of thinking of it, so that I wouldn't turn into, like, all we got out of this was that we sent our kids to camp.
Right.
Because talk about a way to have anyone else in the world want to slap you in the face, right? Is like, we only got some money for nothing, right? So that was kind of my approach to this, to The Changeling as well. We got some money. It wasn't wild amounts of money, so it wasn't like life-changing money or anything like that. So I just said, okay, it'll be good. We'll set it aside. We'll go on summer camp is covered, and maybe enough for us to go on a trip as a family kind of thing. But what I wasn't counting on was the woman who became the showrunner, a woman named Kelly Marcel. Like, literally the day she signed on, so there's a production company, Annapurna, TV, I guess, or Annapurna Pictures. There was a woman who worked there named Allie Krug, who read the book, said, I really think this could be something interesting and good. And then she found Kelly. And Kelly signed on. Kelly said yes. The normal way that it works after that, after the showrunner signs on, or often the way it works, is you get your check, your option check, and the writer is told, now, take a
go
walk
away.
Yes. Because and it's understandable on some level, because the showrunner is a creator and a writer. They want to be free to do what they want, and writers, right, fiction writers are not I would say a lot of us are somewhat controlling people, right? We're a little bit bossy.
Build your own world, of course.
Because it's yours. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you made all these things. How could they change the sneakers from red to green? Right. That destroys the entire novel, right? Kind of thing. And so a lot of showrunners don't want to deal with that, right? But Kelly, a day after she signed it or whatever, flew from LA to New York, said to me, I'm staying at this hotel, let's have lunch. And we sat down and had like a 3-hour lunch where we talked through all these things. And even though our lives on paper were very different, she's a white British woman. I'm a black kid from Queens. But there were all these elements of the story in the book about like parents who didn't quite muster up, about children in danger on some level, all the things. And then also the way that then when one thinks about it's your turn to be a parent, the way you think you can think, I'm going to fix all the mistakes of the people who raised me, which is its own other mistake, right? Which is its own other trap and all this kind of stuff. And we bonded over all these things. And then Kelly did this thing that really cemented what the life of things was next, was then she came on the other side of the booth. She took out her phone, took a selfie of the two of us together, and she sent it to the producers. And she said, this is who's making the show. And it was a lesson to them, like, no matter what, this is who's making the show. And that became true as a result. Like, so Kelly, it wasn't in the sense like I didn't go with Kelly to do pitches and stuff like that, because she's the pro, she had the experience. So she was doing those things. She didn't need me for that. The way it began that we were working together was like she would write the script. She would send me the script before she sent it to anybody else. She would ask me to read it. Is there anything I noticed, anything that could be changed, anything that wasn't quite working? And then I would send her back any notes I had, and then she would send it on to the producers. So it became this very intimate relationship, even though she was in LA at one point, then in England at another point. So it was all phone calls and email, but it was very, very like, this is ours. And she really stuck with that. So much so then that, so in my deal, I was going to be listed as something called a co-executive producer, which essentially meant like if the show got made every episode, I'd get a little check, right? But I didn't have anything to do with making the show. And Kelly was like, I want Victor much more involved in the show, so he should be an executive producer. And what that means is you get a medium-sized check for every episode if it comes in. But even more importantly, then you need to be there while they're filming. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, like, we filmed in New York for 5 weeks, around the corner from where we were living at the time in Washington Heights. I was on set every day when I didn't have to be with the kids. And then over the summer, I think it was two summers ago, the shoot went to Toronto to do essentially all the interior stuff and all that. Me and my family moved to Toronto for 3 months, and I was on set every day, you know? So all that is to say, it was an absolute dream of an experience. And really, like, as time has gone by, I've only come to appreciate more and more how generous Kelly was to me. And also how much, because she had said as well, like, I don't want anybody saying, like, the white British lady ruined your black show. Like, so I need to be able to talk with you about these things, yeah, and whatever. And so I want you paid for your work. So come up and be this kind of thing. And so in that way, I was like, I got to be on casting meetings, on production meetings also, and learn the business and all that kind of stuff. And that was part of Kelly's point, was like, I want you to learn this in case you want to move into TV in some sort of way. So it was amazing, honestly, selfishly. And then the show itself, it follows the book very closely for like the first 3-4 episodes. And then it starts to veer, because part of why Kelly came on board was she's like, the Changeling is really about the guy's perspective. It's about Apollo. It's really like in his head, but she was a new mother. She was married at the time. She was like, I think I can fill out a little more about the wife's perspective, and I want to do that. And then as we talked some more, she came to understand my mom, as I was saying, her journey to come to the States, her bravery. And it made her think a little bit about her mother. And she was like, I want to also give time to the mom. Right. And so in a way, the show became the book plus more, as opposed to a lot of times it'll be a little part of the show. A little part of the book becomes the show and the rest is thrown away. And that wasn't what happened. So like, other people have their own reactions to the show, and I respect that, right? Like, I mean, because it's a winding thing. Like, Kelly's whole point was like, I'm not explaining, to the point we discussed earlier, she's like, I'm explaining nothing. You got to watch this show close. And she was like, and I really feel like if we make this beautiful enough, interesting enough, people watch it the first time, they'll say like, I don't know what the hell's going on. And then if they watch it a second time, they'll start to see, oh, all these things are like built in there. They're all in there. But and it was a risky thing to do, right? And like, I would say the reaction has been a blend of like, wow, this is beautiful. And wow, what the hell is going on? Like, that is what our show is.
I would actually describe your book like that too.
I would say it reflects the source material.
Exactly. Really well.
I would say at this point in my life, I think I have accepted or have leaned, I've sat comfortably in the place of like, and that's who I am. And hopefully that's interesting to some people. And that's okay. You know, so like I love the show without reservation. And I'm so proud of it. And I also understand people are like, what the, I get both.
Yeah.
And I respect both.
I feel like both can be true at the same time.
Both can be true. Absolutely.
I love like, so there. I love sometimes getting into stories where I'm like, wait, I don't know what's happening. Yes. But I'm like in it. Like I'm here for it. I'm going to find, like, I know I'm going to figure it out in the end. And it's like a part of the experience too.
Just yeah.
Like, trying to
it can be yeah I think so I mean I think and for this project in particular I think Kelly was really she was really invested in like to that point like I do want it to feel like the book and you know the book is also it doesn't have the opening page like here's what's going to happen in this book and that like every 100 pages it almost says here's a different book. And now here's another book, right? And I love that, but like, you know, it's...
Maybe it doesn't have to be on the opening page. Maybe it can be like, go to the author's website. If this is the
thing that you know, it's kind of...
It can just be, dear Robin, to Robin, please go to www.victorlaval.com.
You know, it's funny you say that, but I almost feel like there would be some joy in like, if number one, we updated my website, but if there was a channel that just said, what the F? And you click on it and it's me just going through every book like, okay, let's talk through this book. Here's what it is and here's what it is. Like that might actually be like a fun thing to have.
You know? I would watch it. I would
now you got me thinking about it.
A guaranteed view for me.
Things you could do. Yes. You have a lot of things on your plate currently.
Yes.
As in the past and in the future. So based on what you can share with us, would you mind telling us a little bit about what you may have, or maybe just be vague? And we'll have to puzzle it out later, give a primer to us all about what it actually is later, what you have coming up and is going on your plate currently and that you're hoping to have come out next.
Yeah, well, I would say... Well, in the short term, I don't know if you or any of your readers are viewers are comic book readers, but I've been writing for Marvel. This there's a in the X-Men universe is a character called Sabretooth, who is awful, who's truly evil, and I wrote 2 5-issue miniseries about him last year. And they were leading up to something that just dropped yesterday in the pages of Wolverine. We're calling it the Sabretooth War. And it's like a 10-issue mini where, you know, Sabretooth and Wolverine, those characters have like a longstanding hated history. But myself and the writer of Wolverine, whose name is Benjamin Percy, we were given the allowance. They said like... we want to end this. We want this war, this series to be the, if you're open to it, the most violent Wolverine comics ever written. And we said, okay, we can do that. And then to my great joy, the first issue 41 of Wolverine dropped yesterday. And there've been a couple of YouTube things that were sent and a couple of folks on Twitter where it's just people who go like, wow, who have read the comic going just like, they said it would be violent, but I didn't think it would be this violent and knowing like, and it's only going to get worse from here. So I'm so happy and I'm so joyful about that existing, right? And being allowed to let that sort of like muscle work. And then I will say one of my other books, we're waiting to see if we get the green light. I really think in like the next, we're being told in like the next week or two, if they will green light this adaptation of another one of my books. We've already written all 6 episodes of the book, I mean of the show. We are like just sitting there ready to just go. And if it happens, we would shoot it this summer. And it would be on the air, I imagine, next year. And I guess I should keep it vague since they haven't literally greenlit it yet. But right. Like, it's really like at that line where we're talking about actors and all this kind of stuff. And it would be really fun if that was the case. And that one, I will be show running with somebody else, like even more actively, so that I can move more into like the TV, running TV shows kind of world, as well as writing books and comics. So wow. I'm excited for that. Yeah.
That's cool. It also is funny in a way that like this episode is going to post next month. So time. Oh, wise,
so maybe it will be announced. Yeah. That would be so fun. Yeah. I really hope. Yeah, I'm really hoping they'll, you know, all these things, they like, even the Changeling, that, you know, is like it's coming and then it's not coming and then it's coming, you know, so mm-hmm. it's kind of a frustrating world because it doesn't really exist until it airs. And then, of course, some streamers can then just make it disappear.
Disappear, yeah.
Right.
Which is all other level of frustrating.
That's a discussion that we could really have.
I know.
Well, and like, and it's what just, they make disappear.
Yeah. Strategically, like which voices are the ones that they,
consider disposable.
Mm-hmm. You should definitely have that discussion and possibly, you know, involve some of our representatives in the government about that discussion as well, because it seems very scary. It's a scary world.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if nothing else, I saw somebody when they got rid of the, was it the Batwoman show?
Batgirl
movie. Mm-hmm. Somebody coming on and talking about like, this is just a reminder that like, why you still need DVDs.
Yeah,
like don't get rid of your DVDs, and if they special issue any of these things, I know they won't do that because they don't even release it. But like, if you love it, just buy it because it'll disappear.
Yeah, there's been a whole like new resurgence of that because of that fear, and I've been like, I gotta get a DVD player now.
Yeah,
I know my
that's
my
the dad hard part is like, oh,
where do you find these things? My dad is vindicated because he buys DVD everything and has been for years, and we've been like, why? But now
he came back. He was right. Forward thinking. Yeah. That's right.
At least also books me like, oh crap, am I becoming a hoarder? Like I'm just holding on to all
that's
the things.
Right.
Well, you can't trust corporations to let you keep. I mean, even like, I'm hesitant. Like, what it'll say, like, would you like to download, like buy this book as an ebook? And I like reading ebooks, but then there's a part of me that just kind of goes like, but you're at some point going to decide I don't own this anymore.
Yeah.
And I have no recourse. I can't sue you because it's in somewhere in the, you know, accepting the thing.
Terms.
It says in there, like, whenever we decide you don't own this ebook anymore, it's gone.
But even stranger, like they can change the words, like they can like edit, they can edit
is that
your
right?
version.
Yeah,
yeah. They can and they the can just the... switch up your version. So like
I have
a whole other story.
I stopped buying ebooks, not buying, but I stopped buying like full price ebooks because I bought a book that then was turned into a movie and they changed the cover to the movie cover and they never changed it back. And I was like, this is ridiculous. I don't buy it just felt like, do you remember when U2 came on your phone and your iPhone and it just felt
bad? I do.
Yeah.
Like, I don't believe they changed the words of the book, but like to just like all of a sudden the cover was different and I couldn't get it back. And like, I was like, wow, that's scary.
Yeah. They should at least, it should have at least been, which would you prefer to see?
Yeah.
Right. Like, cause it doesn't cost, it's no more space. I mean, or it's minimal extra space, you know? But it comes down to like, well, no, but we're in control of your
stuff,
reality. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Next story idea.
That's right.
She's like, let me write this down. Just make sure that there is a special, here's what you can expect.
Right, it's a writing prompt. Like, that, I like, now I'm like, oh, that's a writing prompt I might work on.
That is a good one, actually. Good one.
Yeah.
Episode of Black Mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Can you let folks know where they can find you and your work?
Sure. I mean, really the only thing I got is I'm on Twitter for however long that lasts. You can find me there. I have a website, victorlaval.com, but I haven't updated it in a while. I'm not the greatest online presence is actually what that means,
but they can find you in bookstores.
But you can find me in bookstores or as an ebook. Oh. No. Well, which cover will it be?
That's the question.
True. The Changeling has a great cover. So
it's such a beautiful cover.
And the other cover,
Well, they, you know, actually, that was one of the few ones where, like, because the question was, like, when the Apple TV, when they said they were going to do it, there was a question, maybe, would there be Lakeith and Clark on the cover? Would there be a whatever? And then even, like, Apple, everybody was like, that cover is just too nice.
Yeah.
We can't change that cover. And we all were like, yes, don't change that cover. As wonderful as those actors are.
Yeah.
It's so good, you know. So felt very lucky.
Art appreciation is very underrated.
Yes.
I love that we got that. I will say, thank you to you, but also thank you to all the listeners who are joining us today. Join us again on Wednesday for our next episode of Wizard Team, where we'll be back to reading Amari and the Great Game by B.B. Alston.
And thank you for having me. Let me say,
yes. Thank you for joining us.
This is a great conversation.
This is wonderful. Wither Team is a part of the Black Nerds Create Collective. If you want to keep up with our content, you can check out our website at blacknerdscreate.com. And unlike Victor, we are very online. So you can follow us on Twitter at Wither Team Pod and at Black Nerds Create. Thank you.
Thanks.